Hello there. I wanted to continue on our series in Luke chapter 9, 51 through 10, 24. This week we're in 10, 1 of Luke. And this is where I wanted to go all along, but it's taken me 5 weeks to get here. this is the account of Jesus sending out the 70 or the 72. Depending on which one of those you hold to. Hendrickson points out, he's a commentator on the New Testament and Luke in particular, that after the previous three would-be disciples, it's a delight, and I quote, to read about a large group of sincere and enthusiastic disciples of Jesus who offered no excuses when called to serve. Without reservation, they answered the call and, to a considerable extent, were successful in their mission. See verse 17. Again, that's Hendrickson saying that. Now, Jesus is on his way to Jerusalem, according to 9:51. This is getting close to the end for him in this book. And he has resumed his trip after these encounters that he had prior to 10:1. Some find that he is as determined as ever. And of course, 9:51 says that he had determined, or he was determined, that is, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, so he's on his way. But on the way, he takes time to, of course, appoint the 70 or the 72. There is equal evidence for 70 and 72. It's just a real difficult problem, but it doesn't really make any difference. One has to wonder whether or not this is all of the disciples that he had at this point in time. I mean, 70 or 72 is quite a few. You hear only about the 12 predominantly, but there were at least this many people who were willing to follow him and to obey him and go when he said go. Now, the 70 were sent out by their discipler, Jesus, which points to me, an expansion of his ministry from just Jesus and the 12. It's expanding out and giving us a clue that that was the goal from the very beginning. Now, some find symbolic meaning in the number of disciples, whether it's 70 or 72, but I don't want to spend any time on that. It's all speculation anyhow. But regardless, this is a fairly large group. Now, we're not given their identities. We don't know anything else about them except that they are sent. Are you amazed, as I am, that Jesus had such a large group of followers? You know, that group, of course, has grown to millions, and I don't know how many, of course. There's no way of knowing, but one day perhaps we will. But it begins with 12, and now he's at 70 or 72. Things are happening. People are believing. Seems to me this is quite a few followers, of course, even if this is all of the followers at this point. Now, they're appointed. Once again, I mentioned that. That means that they're designated as his apostles. This sending out of the 70 has no parallel in any of the other Gospels. You see bits and pieces of it, and you see the 12 being sent out in the other places, but it's not, none of them are exactly the same. The same things that he tells the 70 you will find in Mark. And so anyhow, this is just a unique event to Luke. And they were identified, and they would identify with the Lord as they went out. Stein, one other commentator, points out that this is roughly one for every nation of the world, and he apparently counted all the different nations that would grow out of the people in Genesis chapter 12. So I don't know if that's true or not. Other people have lots of other information about why 70. I just assume that that's all there were in those days. So who knows? But the Lord, compared to, some churches, this is a fairly large group, and the whole bunch of them goes. It's as if he called out to the church in Petersburg and said, "Hey, everybody, I want you to go to other towns and heal and cast out demons and all of that." And everybody went. Can you imagine? That's a pretty significant happening. So this appointment has definite results, as we'll see later on. But he speaks then about the harvest. The Lord says to them, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore beseech or pray to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." Now, that is interesting in itself to think about. Some people see a connection with the idea of praying and actually being commissioned. Some people will say that Jesus called for them to pray. It almost seems as if that was first in their minds as they explain this. And then they say, "And then they went out." So there was a connection with praying and then being sent out. Well, that's out of order, actually, in the text. So I'm not so sure about that connection. But I do mention it. I think that as you pray for things, the Lord opens up your heart to things and to ministries and to even specific people to go to. So I'll leave it at that. But the harvest, he says, is very, very large when you compare it to the amount of laborers. So he's got 70 compared to the 70. The harvest is even larger. They will need more people. And these people are going, according to the first verse, to every city and place where Jesus himself was going to come. And they went out in pairs. They went out two by two. And that indicates that there would be at least 36 different places that they go to, or 35, as the case may be. Certainly, Jesus doesn't expect to hit every single one of those places before he goes to the cross. That would be a circuitous route, as some have pointed out. But it's an interesting thing to think about. These are places where he would go. Does that mean physically go, or does that mean where he would later, after the resurrection, go? I'm not so sure about that, but it is that they will be going as John the Baptist was to make straight the paths before the Lord. The very same wording is used for the 70. They're going out in pairs ahead of him. Literally, it's before his face. This is exactly what John the Baptist was going to do. So they have taken over that role since John is now dead. So he enlists them to go. He enlists them to pray. They all apparently go. You have no arguing or asking of questions, or even those who would say, "I have something else I need to do." There's none of that. They're all willing. So 70 or 72 are sent. And I'd be thrilled if this was me seeing this kind of response. I think that the Lord Jesus is different than I, of course. But it is truly gratifying to see such a turnout. Of course, he has a larger picture in his mind when he speaks about the harvest. He speaks about the present and perhaps even the future. Maybe this is somewhat prophetic by the Lord. But 70 could do a lot of damage, don't you think? Jesus has at least 70 people on his team who are going out to do his bidding. I am really interested in the fact that they all went. I don't know anything about these folks, but I certainly would like to see a do-over of this at some point. I'd like to see lots and lots and lots of people going out and doing what they went to do. But this is God's harvest that he's talking about. More people are needed. They need to have the same mind and the same goals as the Father and Jesus. And this idea of them praying about it will not go unanswered. We're absolutely positive that this is the will of God. If you want to pray something that's the will of God, then pray for laborers to go into the harvest. But God needs to send them. You don't send ourselves. Why make such a distinction? Because it lifts this whole scenario to a higher plane. These are people who are going into some situations that are not exactly what you would call copacetic. These are people who are going into places that will not just contain Jewish people. These are people who are going in the power and the might and in the spirit of the Lord to do these things, empowered by him and led by his spirit. God needs to send them. We all need to be sent. I think that we are sent, actually, in a very generalized way through the Great Commission. I don't think you really need to concern yourself about whether or not you're sent. But this is a huge event. And like I said a moment ago, this is not just a concern that Jesus has for the Jews alone, but he is concerned that everyone who is a part of that harvest. You know, a harvest speaks about the end of planting and sowing and weeding and watering and all of those things that go into the growth of a field full of plants that you put there. The harvest is the end. And the Lord is talking about something that he knows about at the end of all of this. And that's the harvest, and it's God's harvest. But he's concerned that everyone that's in the harvest be approached and given an opportunity to be touched supernaturally by someone who's sent by him. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but it seems to me that it is. So the Gentiles out there and the Samaritans in the area, they are part of that harvest. They are part of the end goal of this work that Jesus himself starts and continues through his people. They were to go completely, utterly dependent upon the Lord. Now, they're going in pairs, which I'm sure that people can get a hold of, you know, as far as safety is concerned. It's safer to be in pairs. We tell our children that. And, you know, it's something that is obvious that safety would be enhanced by two of them going. Also, with two going, you would have the one being able to help the other if one of them gets hung up at some point and can't quite get the message out, or somebody thinks of another, one of the other thinks of another angle that might be helpful. But the truth is they are going out in pairs because of the idea that they will at some point be rejected and there will be cursing that takes place. And I don't mean swearing and, you know, cussing kind of a thing, but cursing of places that do not receive them. And there is the need for, listen to this, two or three witnesses to be a valid witness against that city. Two or more is what's required as a matter of law for a witness against someone. If you need a place to go, look at Deuteronomy 19:15, number 35:30. Hendrickson concurs with that idea, and he says that in order to be valid witnesses, there needed to be two. Well, that's scriptural. I hadn't thought about that until I read it just recently and never really even considered it, but it is important. So, they are to go literally before his face. That means that they are sent by him. And the word, I am sending you, that's all one word, is apostello, which sounds a lot. I'm sure you can hear the word apostle in it. Now, it doesn't make them apostles, but apostles are sent ones, and so are these. They are sent ones just the same. But they're sent ones as lambs out there amongst wolves. So this is not a safe journey that they're embarking on. In fact, sheep can do very little against wolves. If it were not for the I am sending you, this would be sending people out to the slaughter. But sent, that word apostello, is a different story with a different outcome for sure. And even if it isn't, what greater or higher calling is there than to be devoured by a wolf for the sake of Jesus Christ in the mission that he has sent you on? Now, knowing this beforehand is helpful. It prevents unrealistic expectations, and I think we need to do this more and more with people and let them know what they're in for. But it prepares for when it does happen so that you're not surprised or taken back by it. Now, it's due to Jesus' confidence in himself that this is all taking place, not because they are so good at this or so wonderfully prepared for this or talented to be able to do this. This is about confidence in himself. He's able to handle anything they encounter, and they need to know that from the beginning. They didn't have the resources along with them to rely upon. You can see that they were to go without sandals. Some people say without sandals at all, but it probably means an extra pair. At least I would assume that that's the case. No purse. Well, if you don't have a purse, you don't have any money to put in the purse or carry your resources with you. But he tells people not to greet anyone along the way. This doesn't mean that they're supposed to be discourteous or nasty to people, but Oriental greetings traditionally are very long and time-consuming. So that's what he is speaking about there. Now, they're going to go to houses that will be a place where they spring from, a springboarding kind of a house, their base of operations, whatever house that he tells them, whatever house you go into. Now, that's pretty much giving them open-ended discretion. But when they get there, there's to be a shorter greeting and a procedure than the one on the street that he just forbade them to do. The New Testament counterpart to shalom is what they're supposed to say. First thing. This is almost like a password or an identifier to them about that household because of the response. But this was no everyday idle way to greet others in this case. The disciples not only desire the peace of God upon this household that they're going into, but they bring it with them as well. Now, peace is where I wanted to go ever since we started this, and that's where we're going to go next. But I think that's enough for now. And we will look at this idea of the person of peace and the peace greeting and what happens if somebody rejects that and so on next week, Lord willing. Now, I like to end these sessions with a quote that's not been a quote up to this point, but I decided to look it up and make sure I get it right. It's out of Numbers 6:24, and it is my prayer for you. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you. And guess what the last part is? And give you peace.